So today we're going to talk about Rav Lichtenstein and his relationship to non-Orthodox Jews and, more broadly, to non-Jews, which is sort of the flip side of what we spoke about last time, his relation to Haredim. But at the same, you know, in some ways it's the flip side, in some ways it's actually very different, because as we saw last time, Rav Lichtenstein says his deeper commitments, his more fundamental commitments, are to I guess, Orthodox ideology, as it were. So he has more in common with the Haredi world than with the non-Haredi world. So this is less a question of overcoming apparent obstacles and reaching a deeper connection, and more building that deeper connection in the first place, where it's not apparent necessarily to many people in Orthodoxy. People often assume if you're not Orthodox, you're out, you're worthless, not worth discussing. Not, you know, if you're not Jewish, that's even more off the reservation. You're not part of the community in any way. And we're going to see Rav Lichtenstein in both cases establishes some common base, both with non-Orthodox Jews and with non-Jews, to build on, which, you know, differs from people who are Orthodox or bust, or people who are Jew or bust. Those attitudes, which we'll see, he makes mention of them. They're not as uncommon as some think. They actually do exist in strong form, and probably more so in Israel than in America. The frame we're going to build on Adam Furziger's article on the topic, entitled On Fragmentary Judaism, The Jewish Other in the Worldview of Dr. Aaron Lichtenstein, at least for the first half of this, about non-Orthodox Jews. He develops this theme about fragmentary Judaism. He presented on this earlier in the semester, as we said. But the quote of fragmentary Judaism comes from source number one, Rav Lichtenstein's own article from 1977, where he wrote, "The possibility of fragmentary Judaism, or Jewishness in this case, cannot be dismissed. The traditional Jew may be tempted to limit Jewish self-definition to spiritual commitment while relegating national Hizdahut association or identification to empathy. However, such a view, comfortable as it may be, is simplistic. It is wrong logically because nationality is no less defining than religion, and it is wrong morally and halachically because it understates and undercuts the bonds that link the secular and even the assimilated to his fellows and vice versa." So the claim that on this basis and other sources that Furziger makes is that Rav Lichtenstein is committed to a fragmentary Jewishness, the idea that even if we're, you know, Orthodox Jews and non-Orthodox Jews, or observant Jews and non-observant Jews, are not on the same page with regard to everything, even with regard to some of the core things, the bindingness of the Torah, even the existence of God, things like that, commitment to mitzvos, even though they're on different pages in terms of that, you still can and must recognize the fragmentary Jewishness, the points of contact. We're all Jews on a national plane, even if we're not Jews on a religious plane, even if, you know, some of us are not Jews on a religious plane. And it's important to build that basis, that common ground between Jews who are observant and Jews who are not. That's the broader claim of Furziger, but this first source, we saw it. And we're not going to go through all the places that Rav Lichtenstein discusses this. He himself pointed to several of them when he spoke earlier this semester. We'll focus primarily for this part of class on the chapter in Seeking His Presence, Mevakshei Panecha, where Rav Lichtenstein talks in one of the chapters about relating to secular Jews. Our brethren, all the children of Israel, Achenu kol b'nei Yisrael, it's not the exact quote, but relating to secular Jews, where the question is framed as there's two basic attitudes in relating to secular Jews. There's an attitude of that says secular Jews are, you know, don't really contribute anything, but what can you do? Nebuch, it's not their fault. They grew up, they're Tinok Shenishba. They grew up assimilated. They didn't know that they could or should be observant, so we can't blame them. But you know, that's, so they're an empty cart, I think is the term that the Chazon Ish says on that approach. Then there's the other approach of Rav Kook, which is to say that's not true, that they have nothing to contribute. They have what to contribute, and we see that through Zionism. The Zionists, the secular Zionists, built the state, and the religious Zionists built on that, right? Gained from that and took it a step further. So we should value secular Jews, especially secular Zionists, for what they did contribute. So these are two different approaches, and the question was, which of these do you see as as the better approach? And Rav Lichtenstein says he rejects both of them. He thinks both of them have underlying assumptions that are problematic. And he gives a few different reasons. One is that both categorizations judge the whole community based on a single definition. And is that really so fair? People in the community are different from one another, have different emphases, act differently. And just because they're not observant doesn't mean you can put them all in one box. And it's not really right to judge an entire community in that way. Of course, it's not to say that he didn't have strong feelings about whether one should be observant or not, right? But to judge a whole community and to say, well, you know, okay, you get an excuse. If the whole community gets an excuse on something, or they have some value in this particular way, to say they've got a whole community without looking at individuals, there's something wrong with that. Furthermore, the Tinok Shenishba theme, right? You grew up as a captive. That's the basis. That's the parallel. Right? The Gemara in Shabbos talks about someone who's captured from a young age, doesn't know about Shabbos, and then realizes that there's such a thing as Shabbos. So the comparison is these people grew up in a culture where they couldn't really recognize the value of Judaism, and it's as if they didn't know about Shabbos at all. So that takes away any agency. It takes away any of their ability to decide for themselves, as it were. Right? It's like they had no choice in the matter. They grew up not religious. They were going to be not religious. They had no option to stay religious, which is not really fair. It gives them no credit. And also, it doesn't focus on anything of value in their life. It says, okay, the best you can say about them is they're a Tinok Shenishba, that they have an excuse. But you can't say you're not going to be able to say anything positive about them on this approach. But, as he writes, there are many such people who devoutly perform acts of kindness. Many are deeply concerned about their future, about the direction and existence of the Jewish people, not to the state of Israel, the Jewish people as a nation. They have things, they have values that are deep Jewish values, whether that's chesed, whether that's commitment to the Jewish nation. They may have a different vision, but they also have accomplishments. And we can't ignore their accomplishments like the Chazon Ish, nor can we say all their accomplishments are for building the Jewish state, like Rav Kook. Those are both problematic approaches, to either to deny they have any agency, to deny they accomplish anything, to say everything they accomplish is in this box, to judge the whole community based on one perspective, that really seems to be an inappropriate approach, in his opinion. Right, and then there's another point he mentions, that according to the Chazon Ish's approach of Tinok Shenishba, the underlying assumption is that if only you knew there was an option of being religious, and you were exposed to it at the right time, you definitely would do it. And whatever you're doing now is against your own will, and or against your own better judgment, if you would have it. You happen to not be able to have judgment, but if you would, you would immediately become religious, and something deeper, deep down, you really are religious. Which, you know, if you would say that to the person, they'd find it offensive. If you're telling me what I believe deep down, I know what I believe deep down, and it's not observant Judaism. At the same time, and actually it's funny, I had a correspondence with someone asking there about Rav Lichtenstein's position on these issues, and I said, you know, he really was opposed to the idea of Tinok Shenishba for these reasons. And they said, but then how does he solve all the technical issues? Because halachically, a person who intentionally violates the Torah has all sorts of ramifications, and they're more severe than a person who does it, as it were, unintentionally or not fully realizing. So Rav Lichtenstein is willing to apply the category of Tinok Shenishba in these cases, like a secular Jew cooks on Shabbos in the army, that it doesn't prohibit all the food in the same way as it would if they were a Tinok Shenishba. Tinok Shenishba, we treat it like Tinok Shenishba rather than as a willful violation. Or similar other things, maybe a Stam Yenam, the person pours wine. In those cases, he's willing to apply this category, almost as like a technical leniency where it's necessary, but to use that as a sweeping statement and a way of viewing the whole community and every individual within it is, as he says, condescending, disrespectful of the divine image of man, the Tzelem Elokim. Even if it's someone who doesn't act the way we want, they still have a Tzelem Elokim. We can't deny and debase that. Very powerful, powerful point. Rav Kook's perspective, he adds that it values history over morality. Right? It doesn't matter these people don't keep the Torah, they don't do what they're supposed to do. They play a role. They play the right role in history that helps us. Therefore, they're to be valued. And that there's a problem there, which is that you're not valuing them for their ethical action. You're valuing them for the role they're playing. And, you know, how can you just ignore that spiritual place in their lives? So he rejects both of those approaches. And he writes, I believe that a proper Jewish moral Torah perspective, it's a lot of adjectives, recognizes and appreciates partiality. Again, this idea of fragmentary or partial Judaism. Right? That's what we're embracing. Certainly, if I'm developing an ideology, I try to develop a maximalist, all-inclusive Torah-based system. Right? If you said your perfect world, your perfect observance, what does it look like? Torah is at the center. But let us assume a certain person or group doesn't observe Shabbos, doesn't keep Taras HaMishpacha. Do I care? Is it inconsequential to me whether this Jew hates the Torah, is indifferent to Torah, or thinks of it fondly? right? Even if it's insufficient. Even if someone's not going to keep the Torah, let's assume we're talking about chilunim, they're not keeping the Torah. Do you not care at all what their attitudes are towards it? Obviously you should care about that. Obviously there are other things beyond the binary of observant or not. And you need to treat people as individuals and see what exactly they believe. Try to find common values where they exist and work from there. And that's what he writes. He tells his students entering the rabbinate, they have to enter the field with a recognition and appreciation for partial accomplishments. Right? Recognize when people do part of what they really ideally should be doing. And not in the sense of, oh, they'll help me out politically. That's what I'm interested in. No, to actually find common values and to respect them. Later on in the discussion, he was asked about conservative and reform rabbis, and the implication was, don't you think that it's worse to be conservative or reform than to be secular, which in Israel often is the attitude taken? And he says that's absolutely not the case. Now, tactically, often, especially in the diaspora, there'll be a case where a conservative or reform movement is trying to define policy on Jewish policy on an issue, and in that case, because the secular Jews don't really have concern for some of the religious questions, in that case, there may be like a technical disagreement, but definitely, as he writes, that that's a technical point. But more on a deeper level, if I ask myself whether I prefer a person who believes that God exists in the world, that the Jewish people has the Torah, even if he doesn't believe in the divinity of the Torah, or one who doesn't share these fundamental beliefs, the answer is clear. It's obvious that the people with the shared values, in this case the Reform and Conservative Jews, as opposed to secular Jews, those are people to be preferred, as it were. That doesn't mean that there won't be more clashes in practical cases, but fundamentally speaking, those are the people where we share values. And that's what this whole approach is about. It's not all or nothing. It's not Orthodox Jew like me or you're worthless. It's the goal is to try to find shared values, which within the Jewish realm, these are shared Jewish values. Torah, God, Jewish peoplehood. We're going to see more broadly with non-Jews, it'll be other fundamental bases. So we'll get there. We'll get there, yeah. And that's how he ends off, that we need to recognize the value and the challenges of others, people in different situations than ourselves. That's why, Orthodox Jew and the other, this category of the other, someone different than yourself, but to try to appreciate and understand them, not something Rav Lichtenstein wrote about all the time, the way that, Levinas or someone else did, but something that he valued, to appreciate where other people are coming from, to find the shared values and to work with them. So that really comes out of the chapter in Mevakshei Panecha, and Furziger builds on this as well in his article. Rav Lichtenstein's reticence towards totalistic perceptions of Jewish others informs his approach to pragmatic issues of cooperation with non-Orthodox leaders and groups as well. Right, that sort of builds from that basis of finding the common values, that extends out to ways that he's open to people working together. He traces this theme of accepting others throughout his writings. I don't know how much time you want to spend on this right now, but the point is, even though we have differences, and they're real differences with others, that shouldn't stop us from appreciating what we have in common and even learning from other groups. That Furziger points to in a couple of places that sometimes non-Orthodox communities do a better job at certain mitzvahs or certain areas of their Judaism, and we have to learn from them as well. The summary that he writes towards the top of page 4 in the handout, Rav Lichtenstein has been examining and developing his perception of a range of Jewish others throughout his over 50-year career, which he traced. The specific ways through which his appreciation of the fragmentary came to practical fruition evolved over time. He sees a few distinctions across the writings. I'm not convinced that there are massive ones, but there may be slight ones. But these were all built upon the core conceptualization that he developed early on. The view that he's put forward is sui generis, is really one of a kind, and does not follow directly from any of the predominant approaches within 20th century Jewish orthodoxy. Another thing that Furziger notes is that he builds on this covenant of fate that the Rav talks about. So it's not just shared values, whether peoplehood or Torah or God in different degrees, but also a shared fate. Now he mentions that, although according to Furziger, it's not as central, that all Jews share a fate. That for the Rav was central in Kol Yodid Ofek, very timely essay, if you have a chance to read over the next couple of days, about Jewish fate, Jewish destiny. We all have the same fate. We all were targets of Hitler. But at the same time, destiny, whether we choose to follow a certain religious approach or not, that may differ from person to person. that the Rav would really put that forward as the main distinction between the distinction between Orthodox Jews who share not only the fate but the destiny as well, and non-Orthodox Jews who at least share the fate. Rav Lichtenstein mentions that, but as Furziger argues, really focuses more on shared values, and not just that we're all Jews, we're all liable to be attacked equally, but also that we really have shared values across the board. Now, there's a limit to this view of including people. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but there's an article on Brother. There's really at least two articles on this. Brother Daniel and the Jewish Fraternity, a story involving a certain Jew who converted to Christianity, became a priest, and then wanted to make Aliyah based on the law of return because he was Jewish, and a whole discussion about whether someone like that should be considered Jewish or not. In the 60s, Rav Lichtenstein wrote an article about it, trying to figure out at what point you lose your Jewish identity, if ever. Right? In general, you know, a person who does commit sins is still a Jew. That's clear. Even a person who intentionally sins is still a Jew. But what about someone who gives over their whole identity to another religion and really forsakes their Judaism? Like this character, this individual, and after going through the sugyas, and it's there's a lot of different categories, a lot of different cases, there's a somewhat complex answer where if you're born Jewish, you remain a Jew in some sense, but in another sense, you lose your Judaism. Rav Lichtenstein uses the idea between the Shem Yisrael versus the Kedushat Yisrael. You always have at some basic level the Shem Yisrael. You're always a Jew, and you always are expected to return to Judaism to observe it. But at the same time, you may give up your Kedushat Yisrael. Wherever there is complete personal alienation, resulting in total lack of identification with Jewry, Kedushat Yisrael expires. You can lose that, as in the case of Brother Daniel, arguably. You can discuss, well, at what point do you lose your Jewish identity? Does it happen as soon as you commit fully to a different religion to the exclusion of Judaism? Maybe only your children get it. But that's a question of detail. In principle, there is some limit in that regard. It goes with the more detail you have to reject the future and the past of Knesset Israel to really lose that. Fine. Another way of losing your another limit for this openness is when you apply tolerance practically, how far that goes. Right? Just because we're looking at values, the connections and the shared values doesn't mean that there are no limits at all. And there's a couple of articles on this, but I shared a couple of quotes from this one, the parameters of tolerance, where Rav Lichtenstein stakes out somewhat of a middle position. He mentions here, source number 5, in the public arena, American Jewry has been torn asunder for over a generation by issues of who sits with whom, of how to strike a balance between confraternity and concern over implicit legitimization of deviation, and at the private plane, decisions over with whom to share a platform or a volume are a common occurrence. So he says, really, it's been a fairly large issue in American Orthodoxy and American Jewry. People fighting with each other. I can't be on a panel with him. I can't be in a book with him. We need to totally separate from these people. And he says he accepts the fact that may sometimes be necessary. You don't want people to draw the wrong conclusions. But he says to take a more moderate approach. Not that I'll sit with anyone, even if it gives the implication that I endorse their views. If it really gives that implication, I shouldn't sit with them. But at the same time, you need to be more open than the extremists on the other side. As he puts it, there's no halacha about this per se. There's no Shulchan Aruch instructing us about social ostracism, and you need to have a mix of sensitivity and judgment. Use your wise judgment and try to figure this out. He gives a few directives of how to act. First, he says they try to keep a broad and subtle range of responses to be able to not just have your automatic reflex be they're not Orthodox, delete, or something like that, right? Reject. That shouldn't be the automatic. You need to have a range of responses depending on the scenario, depending on the person, depending on the case. Second, in cases of doubt where to draw the line, we ought generally counsel moderation. Be more moderate. When in doubt, be more moderate, because if you're in doubt, probably it's not going to be a real threat. There's no real danger. Do the best you can to accommodate. And then third, with respect to both juridic and social spheres, especially the latter, it behooves us to distinguish between two elements, between toleration and tolerance. Tolerance is a mindset and attitude. Toleration is a course of action. And he says you can distinguish in either direction. You might have more tolerance in theory, but less toleration in practice, or vice versa. You might have more toleration in practice, but less tolerance in theory. To some degree, this is a personality thing. Right? Some people are very open-minded in theory, but in practice, just can't stand certain things happening and take opposition to them. Or vice versa. Some people, in theory, have a narrower view of things, but in practice, they're like a live and let live type of person. He actually says the Rav and Rav Kook are on opposite sides of that. The Rav was more limited in theory, but more open in practice, whereas Rav Kook was broader in practice. You know, everything has Kedusha in it, but in theory, Rav Kook was broader in theory, but in practice was much more limiting and much more ready to throw people out, as it were. So that's Rav Lichtenstein on non-Orthodox Jews. Generally, has a new approach. It's not about telling people that they secretly are helping me without realizing, or that they actually don't really have any say over their decisions, but to take them at their word. They're non-Orthodox by choice. We need to respect that. And part of respecting that is finding the common values, finding what we believe in that, what we accept that they're doing, what we're happy about, and to find that common ground. Although at a certain point, there's no more common ground. If you really give up your Judaism completely, then the common ground of all people, but you lose your Jewish peoplehood in that case. And also, despite the fact that there is this recognition of commonalities between Orthodox and non-Orthodox Jews in some cases, there also is a need, pragmatically, to figure out what degree of tolerance is optimal and what degree of working together is optimal and when you need to stop. Something that came up, when I was working on college campus, this came up a fair amount. Some people would say you should never be on a panel. You should never even work in a Hillel. How can you work in a Hillel? You're working on the same team as, rabbis of other denominations. You're giving them legitimacy. Rav Lichtenstein's approach, and he was a posek for many of the issues involving OUJLIC, which was built on the model of integrating with the Hillel, is that it depends practically on whether it helps or not. If it'll strengthen the Orthodox community to have the Orthodox rabbinic couple be in the Hillel, then you should by all means do that. If it'll hurt them, then you shouldn't. He certainly thought it was helpful, and can have a longer discussion on that another time. So that, so much for the relation between Orthodox Jews and non-Orthodox Jews. We'll move now to the relation between Jews, or I guess observant Jews' view of non-Jews. Some of these things we've seen already when we've spoken about universalism. Rav Lichtenstein has a fairly universalistic view overall. That shows itself in a few different ways. First, maybe foremost, in his invocation of literature, right? Not Jewish literature, literature of all, really primarily of the West and of the Christian West, but of thinkers of all sorts. The story goes that Rav Lichtenstein was once visiting Israel and met with Rav Avadia Yosef, and they were talking about a certain sugya, and Rav Lichtenstein mentioned in passing, that this point aligns with something that Kierkegaard said. And Rav Avadia Yosef said, can you say that name again? I actually never heard of that achron. Some people don't, most poskim don't usually integrate philosophers into their thought, but for Rav Lichtenstein, it was a natural part of how he worked. I was just listening to a shiur of his the other day. He was talking about the nature of Hashkafa and the Ramban, and just within the shiur, like between a sentence about this pasuk and that pasuk, it was just like a survey of 18th century views on pantheism or the like. It just sort of, that was just naturally part of the way he viewed things, was that. So that in itself, the view of secular knowledge integrating with Torah in that way already tells you something about how Rav Lichtenstein viewed non-Jews, right? The fact that we can learn from them, accept the truth from whoever you hear it, as the Rambam said, that certainly was his attitude. Not just that, but his views towards ethics that we've seen, right? Does Judaism recognize an ethic independent of halacha? Or the answer basically is yes, assuming that you define the terms the way most people would, which means that not just literary sources can be useful, or historical information about different positions are useful, but a real source of how we should act is our ethical impulses. And presumably Jews don't have different, maybe it's honed in a certain way, but fundamentally your ethical impulses are innate. That's at least the presumption. They're shaped by society in some ways, they're innate certainly in other ways. So that also gives credence to a certain view of the outside world beyond Judaism, a view of non-Jews. I included on the sheet another thing we've seen already, which is the chapter in Bai's Light about whether Torah supersedes universal values or not, or whether Torah builds on those values, right? If there's a Shem Mitzvah, non-Jews have an ethical code, does Torah build on those and expand it? Or does Torah offer an alternative view and reject them and say that's not important for Jews, that's something else, that's just for the non-Jews? And Rav Lichtenstein is very clear, as he writes, that there are three levels of duty incumbent upon us, human beings, Jews, and B'nai Torah. And the presumption is that they build one upon the other. In fact, the whole chapter is about general responsibilities of humans, right? Looking at Adam and the obligation of the Avdal Shamra to guard the world, to work, develop the world, and to guard it. Those are human obligations that Jews have as well. And not only that, but after the Kritan Brit, after the covenant of Har Sinai, those still apply to Jews. That's his argument. He spends a good piece of that chapter discussing it. We're not going to go through the details here, but his approach is that the covenant, one covenant is built on top of the other. And just the summary section here. Thus, our specific Jewish commitment rests on our universal commitment. And one cannot address oneself only to the specific elements while totally ignoring the general and the universal ones. Right? You need to do both. And therefore, in delineating what a Ben Torah should be striving for, the initial level of aspiration is a general one, to be a mensch, to hold basic universal values, to meet normative universal demands. And then you build on that and you see how specific obligations as a Jew and obligations as a Ben Torah as well. So that's things we've all seen before, and they all point in the same direction. There really isn't that much that Rav Lichtenstein writes specifically about relations between Jews and non-Jews. Probably the most clear formulation, or really the most extensive formulation, it's not that long either, is here in Source 7, a Hebrew language article, Hayachas Lagoy B'Tfisa HaYehudit, the relation to the Gentile in the Jewish conception. Part of a book, Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem, which I haven't read the book, but I'm assuming is about Jewish non-Jewish relations, right? All people are created in the image of God, Nivra B'Tzelem, from 1985. We'll just look at a few highlights from this short piece that are important, and we'll see he makes reference to this. It's important to think about the context, 1985 Israel, and the Datilumi world, and I think some of these trends have only strengthened themselves, where if you're living within a fully Israeli society, there sometimes is the, I guess for Rav Lichtenstein, the Yetzer Hara, the errant view one might have of thinking that Jews are all there is, and especially if the only interaction with non-Jews is in wars and terror attacks, that doesn't necessarily lead you to having the most positive view of non-Jews. And that's a danger that you might have that incorrect view. So he'll refer to that throughout this piece towards the bottom of page 6. He writes, Nikudana motza l'chol tfisa yehudit ruya lishma ba'asher liyachas d'nei noach hi hayidiyah v'ha'akara shemdubar kan b'vnei adam v'lo b'chafatzim. An important line he just starts with, but a basic starting point for any Jewish view of relations with non-Jews that's worth its name, that's worth anything, is the knowledge and recognition that we're talking about human beings rather than objects. I'll call him Mishtamea Vehemit Chayev Mizeh, with everything that follows from that. And you'd hope this wouldn't be necessary to say, but I think, given the context, he felt it might be necessary to say that. Al ben Noach chalim gam otam netunim utchunot shechachmei musar katvu alehem kasher katvu al adam. With regard to non-Jews, we have the same moral obligations that we have towards any person, towards Jews. So chachmei musar, all the authors of musar or ethics of any sort, whatever obligations they say that Jews have to fellow Jews as people, those should apply, of course, to all people. So this is an important point, and this speaks to, for Rav Lichtenstein, being a person, what's the core aspect, what's the core goal of being a person? Very similar to the core goal of being a Jew, which is to recognize and to serve God. And there are many sources that talk about this. Ma enosh ki tizkirenu, in Tehillim. Right? What is man that you are mindful of him? So that's about man, that's about humanity, all people. A lot of sources about Adam HaRishon and his recognition of God. These are important. These tell us the important point that the goal of all people, including of Gentiles, should be to connect to God, and that's why they're Shev Mitzvah Noach. Right, we're all commanded beings, Jews and non-Jews alike. So the question is exactly how this plays itself out, and this partially is a question of of how universalistic or particularistic one's Judaism is. And as we've seen, Rav Lichtenstein is fairly universalistic, and he projects that model not just onto, you know, taking things from the non-Jewish world, as it were, but also exporting his view of life and its meaning to the non-Jewish world back, right? And again, that's not to say, it doesn't mean that he proselytized and said, you know, had like a Noahide covenant they have projects that people, some people have. That wasn't the goal. The point is, at least in theory, if any non-Jew would ask, or for our understanding of how non-Jews should relate to the world, that serving God is central. Rav Lichtenstein makes the very important point of what does it mean to serve God? There are three primary areas that Chazal talk about as avoda, avodan Hashem, service of God in the most specific sense, which are korbanot, tefillah, and Torah. Right? Sacrifices, prayer, and Torah. So offhand, what would you say? Which of those apply to non-Jews?
In terms of the
sacrifice, prayer, and Torah. So the initial assumption is, oh, probably not, I'm not sure it'll work. But as Rav Lichtenstein points out, a non-Jew brings sacrifices, not just their own on their own, but goy makriv korbanot, lo rak bebamash hu mekim la'atzmo, ela af beveit ha-mikdash. A non-Jew can bring sacrifices in the base of Mikdash. Not necessarily the most known source, but it's explicit in many places. There's a whole dispute about what types of korbanos, ola and shlamim, just in ola. That's a question of details. The point is, the Beis HaMikdash is open, Kivei Tivei Tefillah Yikarei L'chol Amim, is open to business for Karbanos from non-Jews. That's Karbanos. What about Tefillah, prayer? We have prayer throughout Tanakh, right, as you were saying. Non-Jews pray too. And Beiti, Beit Tefillah Yikarei L'chol Amim. My house is a house of prayer for all the nations. So that's very clear. And even Torah, what generally we think of, it's Me'orasa, it's the special relation between God and the Jewish people. But even Torah, the Medrash, the Brisa says, it's quoted, "Afilu goy yoshev osek b'Torah mekabel sachar." Even a non-Jew who learns Torah gets reward for it. It's complicated because there are other sources that say that you shouldn't and that it's prohibited. It's a complex issue, but the point is, even Torah, which is in some sense the specific province of the Jewish people, there at least are some sources that say that non-Jews can serve God by learning Torah. So a very broad view of Avodah Hashem for Gentiles, and not that there's much of a chiddush here. He's just quoting sources. These are explicit sources. But I don't know of anyone who's organized them in this way with this idea of saying that non-Jews have an obligation of Avodat Hashem, and these are some of the ways they can do it. At the same time, he says, while we need to distinguish, we need to keep in mind there's two levels of values that we have. We have some values that are universal human values, which obviously we share with non-Jews. And then there's something that's specifically Jewish, you know, and whether you call it Jewish chosenness or specific Jewish obligations, however you look at it, there is this important distinction. And right, Jews have the 613 mitzvot, non-Jews have the Shev mitzvot, they know. The question then is how much, you know, how similar or different you see these as, right? Do you say, well, you know, 7 is a small fraction, it's barely 1% of 613. So obviously, you know, these are not comparable at all, and the 613 dwarfs the 7, and there's very little in common. But as Rav Lichtenstein writes, if you actually read how the Shev Mitzvei Noach are interpreted, you see the Ramban, among others, that really Shev Mitzvei Noach include a fairly wide range of things. So the Ramban says dinim, that the last of the 7 on the usual list, includes all monetary law, basically. What's the examples he gives? Siva otam bedine gneva onaa oshek schar sachir shomrim ones mifate avod nizikin chovel vachaviro malveh velovveh mekach memkar v'keyotzimehen. So it gives a list of basically almost all of Choshen Mishpat, almost all of monetary law. Prohibitions against stealing, against overcharging, against not paying wages properly, laws of guardians, if you watch a person's items, the damages for rape and seducing, other damages, laws of loan, of borrowing and loaning, laws of business. Basically, all monetary law applies to non-Jews, just like it applies to Jews, according to the Ramban and others who follow him. It seems to be the mainstream position. So this idea that, the 613 dwarfs the 7 is not so good. There's actually a lot in common. Although at the same time, there also are other differences. Now, he admits that there are formulations that are anti-Gentile in Chazal. He says, but most of these, if not all of them, are attributable to specific things that specific non-Jews do throughout history that we don't like. For example, waging war on the Jewish people, that's something we generally don't like. Or Avodah Zarah, not something we're big fans of. In these cases, that's where we find these formulations, like Milchama Hashem Ba'amalek Midor Dor. He assumes that's based, it seems like, based on, as the Pasuk says, on their fighting with Israel earlier, among other things, at least, sort of they started the war, and they're not going to be in our good book. But the point is that these specific formulations about opposition to particular cases where non-Jews wage war and the like shouldn't be given too much weight. They shouldn't make us lose sight of the fact that there are all these similarities. And then towards the end of the piece, he talks about this idea of chesed, of doing good, of ethics, as applying to non-Jews as well. There are two different mechayvim or sources, as it were, for chesed, for acting ethically. One of them is v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. That one applies only l'reicha. That is limited to Jews treating other Jews well. But there's another source, acharei Hashem Elokeichem teilechu. You should follow God. Follow God, following God's ways. God is rachum. God is merciful. God is chanun. So we should be the same way. And that applies to all humans. All humans have this obligation of v'halachta v'edracha, following God's ways. And that means that Jews should relate to non-Jews with chesed. And presumably non-Jews should relate to each other with chesed too. But that should be clear. That's one of the basic obligations. There's an obligation of chesed towards non-Jews. Towards Jews, you have a special additional aspect of these are our brethren. You have that as additional aspect, just like you have special obligations to family members you don't have to other people. But that at the same time, there is that obligation. There is an obligation of chesed. Towards the end, he talks a bit more on a social or communal level. Yesh gam tzorech b'cheshbon nefesh. We need a little bit of introspection on this issue. Alein latet da'atenu keitzad higanu l'matzav shebo talmid b'yeshiva tichonit. We need to think about how we get to the situation where an Israeli high school student needs to try to figure out, like, is it mutar or asur to kill a guy? Because the Rambam, as he applies to all people, there should be no one should ever reach a point where that's the question they're asking. Is this how we want to see the results of our education, that people think that? And the presumption is that you only could come to that point if you have a view of non-Jews that doesn't view them as totally human, that views them as somehow lesser or different, and that this is a horrible state of affairs that should be avoided, but one that he sees in Israel at least 30 years ago, and I don't think it's gotten better since then. V'adai she'aleinu lechanech likrat dveikut b'halacha. Of course, we should educate people towards being connected to halacha, but not to this narrow vision. Mukbelet ad kidei kach. It's so limited, toch atimut musarit mukletet, to the point of absolute moral blindness. So that's part of our obligations in the world of ethics, in terms of being ethical and being ethical in our education, to educate people. For halacha in the broad sense, to recognize the broader values of halacha, including in this case, accepting non-Jews as people, as ovdei Hashem, which is the core thing, the specific mitzvos they have, which are many more than seven, and the obligation of chesed that Jews have towards non-Jews, that non-Jews have towards each other as well, and to accept the values of non-Jews as people and as ethical people and as people under God, just like Jews. So that's, again, a similar method, a similar approach to find the commonalities that applies in the realm of ethics, right, as we're all on some level on the same ethical plane, and in terms of secular knowledge, taking wisdom from non-Jews, and this piece, which really lays out the obligations Jews have towards non-Jews, to find the common elements and to build upon them. The idea of a fragmentary Judaism, of viewing people, accepting that there are differences between Orthodox Jews and non-Orthodox Jews, between Jews and non-Jews, but also seeking the common ground, the common basis, so that we have proper appreciation for the other.